You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 189 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Conscious Society, Anthroposophy and the Social Question, translated by Matthew Barton. 8 lectures. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on the 2nd of March, 1919. Yesterday we tried to examine the modern social movement from a particular angle. We found it necessary, when seeking understanding of any movement, to give close study to what lives in the forefront of its adherents' minds and in the minds of the rest of their contemporaries, what lives in their ordinary consciousness, and what, on the other hand, is occurring in the depths of the soul, in subconscious regions. Here we considered three impulses at work in the modern proletarian movement. First, its materialistic view of history. Then, what workers have learned from their leaders about the class warfare that supposedly underlies all historical events. And then we also focused on something that has had such a decisive impact on proletarian souls, the, in quotes, added value theory, as it is known. We saw how these things lie uppermost in the consciousness of the modern proletarian. But in the depths below, something quite different is stirring. As opposed to the illusion that the proletarian harbors today, that all history simply reflects economic processes, and that culture is merely a kind of vapor rising from this reality, the worker, along with all of modern humanity, thirsts for a certain spiritual insight into the world. But he does not know this. He is unaware that in the subconscious depths of his soul, he thirsts for spiritual knowledge. And what stirs in these subconscious regions and is masked by something quite different at the surface often rumbles and erupts in the wildest instincts. Similarly, when the modern proletarian invokes the phrase class conflict, he does not realize that he is only trying to conceal with it another deep longing in the underdepths of modern soul life, the impulse for freedom of thought. On the journey from the subconscious to the conscious mind, the quest for freedom of thinking is transformed into its opposite. The search for freedom in thinking underlies the most extreme adherence to authority, to which mere class consciousness testifies. And true socialism, for which our era yearns in the depths, comes to expression really in a kind of opposite of socialism, in the endeavor to egoistically pocket all added value. If we don't understand the secret of the modern proletarian movement, the social impulses at work today will be hidden from us. Yesterday we looked at these things, and now I'd like to lead on to a consideration of a few truths relating to them. By seeking to look more deeply into what is actually happening, we can gain a very particular relationship to global movements, including those of today. As you know, Bolshevism is a modern social movement in its most radical and extreme form. It is a social methodology little different in content to what other forms of radical socialism intend. If you study the reality and not just the theory of history, it is helpful to examine how certain currents in humanity's evolution come to their most radical expression. For it is here that we can best understand what is otherwise also present, more concealed but no less influential, where radicalism is less dominant. If we want to grasp the historical conclusions that history itself has drawn in the terrible events of today, this historical outcome in Bolshevism, we will need to survey modern culture a little. If you ask who these Bolsheviks are, really, various names will be cited. Predominant among them are, of course, Lenin and Trotsky. But I'd like to tell you about a third Bolshevik, whose name might somewhat surprise you. But from one point of view, he has to be called a genuine Bolshevik. This is Johann Gottlieb Fichte. I have often spoken about him to you and have even tried to illumine his biography from a somewhat deeper perspective. We have reflected here, too, on some of Fichte's chief ideas. It cannot be denied that he was one of the most energetic thinkers of modern times, but he also expressed his socialist leanings in summarized form entitled The Closed Commercial State. If we study what really would arise from Fichte's view of ideal social conditions, we would have to say that it would manifest as Bolshevism. Actually, what Trotsky writes is sometimes very reminiscent, almost identical word for word, insofar as such divergent things can be so, of what Fichte writes in titled The Closed Commercial State. Fichte, of course, is a long-dead Bolshevik. But this is precisely what can invite us to examine this fact a little more closely. We must regard Fichte as a very lonely thinker who arrived at lofty philosophical ideas and who turned his thoughts also to various social injustices as he saw them and to how a just society might eventually emerge. Out of his inner soul he weaves a picture of the social order, conjuring a structuring of society roughly in the same way as modern Russian Bolshevism does, and as its successors will, in its own violent manner. I can understand that many, moved by various injustices still of course existing in society today, will feel fascinated by the very simple outlooks expressed in Fichte's titled The Closed Commercial State. I don't need to go into any more detail about this text here, since it is enough to recall what Bolshevism is doing, and frame it in the cultured words of a philosopher, and then you have titled The Closed Commercial State by Fichte. And this very fact can illustrate why it is right and proper to establish the threefold nature of the healthy social organism, of which I have often spoken. What is the real meaning and purpose of this threefold structure? In public lectures, I have suggested how this mode of social thinking differs from others. I have said that if we examine the reality that has been created here and there in particular state structures, if we study the ideas that socialist thinkers are seeking to realize in practice, we can easily have a sense that a kind of medieval superstition has taken hold deep in their souls. It is as if human souls had a certain craving for superstition. And when this is driven out of them in one form, it seeks to take root again in another. And this is why I am reminded of part two of Goethe's Faust, both in relation to various aspects already existing in society, and also to what socialist thinkers intend. I am thinking of the scene where Wagner creates the homunculus. The homunculus is to be made from mechanical components arranged according to prosaic rational principles. The alchemists, who are regarded today as superstitious people, thought such a thing was perfectly possible and contrasted the artificial creation of a little human, the homunculus, with the origin of a real human organism. One cannot compose an actual human organism from its constituents, but must create the conditions that, in a sense, allow it to arise by itself. In science, people believe that they have overcome this alchemical superstition, yet it still flourishes in views of society. There, people try to create an artificial social order from all kinds of constituents of human will. This mode of thinking is diametrically opposed to the one we propose here, drawing on spiritual scientific foundations. The outlook we propose seeks to shed all social superstition and, in practical terms, to answer the question as to what conditions must be created so that, instead of some person or other being able to realize a socialist ideal through his particular ingenuity, people can create the necessary social forms in reciprocal activity together in society. But here we find that this social organism, just like the natural organism, must actually consist of three relatively independent spheres. Just as the human head, which chiefly bears the sense organs, has a particular relationship with the external world through these sense organs and is centralized in or founded on itself, and just as, in turn, the rhythmic system of lungs and breathing is centralized in itself, as is likewise the metabolic system, these three spheres or systems interacting in their relative autonomy, so it is fundamentally necessary for the social order to be tripartite, and for each of its three domains to have relative autonomy. The autonomous, self-founded, spiritual and cultural organism. The autonomous organism of the political state, in its narrower sense. And the autonomous economic organism must all work alongside each other, each of these entities having their own legislature and forms of administration arising from their own contexts, and the circumstances and forces at work in them. This may sound abstract, but it is precisely what can structure the whole of society to produce the health of the social organism from the interaction and collaboration of these different spheres. It is, therefore, not a question of contriving a fixed model of how the social organism should be shaped. In the social domain, our thinking, you see, does not extend far enough to be able to propose the social organism's structure. An individual can as little realize the structure of the social organism as a person could ever learn to speak if he were first to awaken on a lonely island without any social context. The single human being cannot weave a social context by himself. All social coexistence arises reciprocally, and will only be truly harmonious as human mutuality regulated by these threefold principles. It is only by recognizing this truly practical way of shaping actual life that we can come to understand how someone like Johann Gottlieb Fichte came to contrive a social system whose realization would in fact lead to Bolshevism. What kind of a figure is Johann Gottlieb Fichte? He was one of the characteristic thinkers of modern times, in a sense the man who also developed and honed thinking, which has evolved in the course of time, has changed in character, as you can see from my title, Riddles of Philosophy, in the most energetic way, and gave it its purest form. A figure such as Fichte can show us what thinking becomes if we seek to draw it entirely from itself, alone, from the I, capital. And if we apply this pure thinking, in its intrinsic nature, to the structure of society, too, we obtain the picture that Fichte gave us in titled The Closed Commercial State. But we have to recognize that thinking such as this, Fichtean thinking, is completely unsuited to finding social structure. Thinking drawing upon the impulse of the I is not able to discern social structure, just as a single person alone could not invent speech. Social structure can only be found by first bringing human beings into mutual relationship and interaction, so that they find social structure in their interconnection. To some degree, we have to stop short before certain things relating to social structure, only pursuing the path to the point where you show how people must relate to one another if the social structure is to be realized in their collaboration. This is thinking that corresponds to reality, to actual experience. Fichte's thinking is born from the pure I, as is Bolshevik thinking, albeit in somewhat different form. It is basically antisocial, because it is born only from the manifestations of the I, and specifically does not arise in the life of human community. The community life of the proletariat adopted this form of thought on authority, but it is dictated by the leaders of their movement, and it is important to recognize this. This begs the question as to what is added to the individual's inner life by this life of the community in the social domain. Here, we have to recognize very clearly where this purest form of thinking in Fichte leads us. If you try to read Fichte's books without preparation or previous study of philosophy, just picking them up as you might read the newspaper or books that are easier to digest, or even perhaps current academic works as they are today, you will find them very difficult to follow. You will get the sense that you are being skewered on these thoughts. They are so energetic, but developed in such an abstract way. What Fichte elaborates strikes most people as a cat's cradle of abstract thoughts. Why is this? It is because this thinking is pure thinking, of a kind that the soul weaves above and beyond any experience of the world, that is woven out of itself. If you study Fichte's title Theory of Knowledge, you pass from one clause to the next in lofty abstract heights, so that you often cannot tell why you should be concerning yourself with them at all, since they say absolutely nothing to you. You can leaf a long way through Fichte's title Theory of Knowledge, and you will learn that, quote, the I posits itself, close quote. This thought is elaborated over many pages to start with, followed by, quote, the I posits the not I, close quote. Again elaborated over many pages. Then comes the third thing, quote, the I posits itself as defined by the not I, and the not I as defined by the I, close quote. And by this time you have almost reached the end of his title Theory of Knowledge, which takes these thoughts and elaborates them in a very broad and wide-ranging way. You will say, quote, well, that is of no interest to me whatsoever, for really it is all hollow and abstract, close quote. And yet if you trace Fichte's biography, his life and endeavors, as I presented them to you some time ago, you gain real respect for Fichte, for his quest for pure thinking. To what is this remarkable contradiction due? It comes from the fact that in the course of human evolution, it became necessary at a particular point to reach this pure thinking, filled only by thoughts. Human thinking has otherwise only been filled with images, especially always in ancient times, as I explained again yesterday. Figures such as Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel, by contrast, have thought in pure thoughts, thoughts without pictures. The ancient Greeks could never have thought like this, nor the Romans, nor was it possible in medieval times, since the scholastics, despite all their abstraction, had a quite different quality of thinking. What then was the purpose of developing this abstract thinking in the course of modern times, It arose because people needed to exert themselves. Great inner exertion is required to raise oneself in the Fichtean sense to such levels of abstraction, to elaborate abstractions which strike the man or woman in the street as useless, devoid of all real experience. It is true that it is. And yet it is important to reach this abstract level, to pass through this stage. After taking this first step into such abstractions, one soon develops the inner impulsivity of soul life a little further, to get beyond them and enter spiritual life. There is no healthier path in modern mysticism than to pass through this energetic thinking, and this is why the capacity for it first had to be achieved. The next step on, from, and through this energetic thinking is to come to a real experience of the spiritual. In the passage of history, this naturally all happens very slowly, but that is the path humanity is treading. And this longing, which in fact holds sway in all people today, to pass on from abstraction to the life of spirit, lies secretly also as a force rooted in the underdepths of the proletarian movement. The proletarian does not believe that there are spiritual forces at work in history, but only economic ones. Using the dullest perception, he observes these and regards them as the only factor in history. He thinks that the life of spirit, culture, is just a superstructure, an ideology, a reflection of external economic factors. He thinks like this because when a person looks inward in modern times, he sees only abstractions, having lost the old atavistic visions. He finds only abstract thoughts within him, and they contain no reality for him, which could only be found by taking the further step I just described. For this reason, people seek the reality they inwardly long for only in the external world. And because the worker has been harnessed to merely economic life since the advent of capitalism, he seeks this reality there. What will the next natural, inevitable step be? People will learn to see that the economic order as such does not ultimately offer any real driving force. As history continues, by contrast to this historical materialism, a force will develop within people to penetrate to the spirit. What comes to expression in historical materialism is only a caricature of the longing deep in human souls. And similarly, below class consciousness lies the strength of the single human individual who seeks within him for inner content, and this comes to expression because of a sense of inner emptiness, a lack at present of discernible content, in his adhering to his whole class, feeling strengthened by this whole human context. Thus, all the impulses that today prevail at the surface of the social movement arise from a hidden source, as I have described. And at the time when Fichte was writing, which was not yet ripe for the endeavors of spiritual science, the only thinking that could appear was one that still awaits the approach of the world, of spirit, and is also of no use for external reality. The thinking that should really be applied to the spiritual world leads, when radically, consistently, violently applied to the external sense world, not to the support and cultivation of sense reality, but to its destruction. I have often spoken to you about the functions of evil, describing the forces that are really at work in what we call human evil. I said that if we go one level higher, from our sensory plane to the next adjoining spiritual plane, our spiritual vision can teach us what is actually at work in evil. You see, if the powers active in thieves, robbers, and murderers were not wrongly expressed here in the sense world, but were metamorphosed, transformed to a higher plane, they would be fully justified. They belong there. Evil is good in the wrong place. It is only because the Ahrimanic powers press down into our world what really belongs in a quite different world that evil takes its particular form. And thus, a destructive thinking arises, not one that can await fulfillment from the world of spirit, when a social ideal is spun from human inwardness. This can give us insight into the difference between all the numerous abstractions that prevail today, and what we seek here as a really practical grasp of the social organism. What this stimulates in human community, what people then develop together if proper community is established, does not manifest abstract thought. Abstract thoughts come to expression when the human being is really genuinely lonely, not when people are together. In the latter case, hidden, mysterious imaginations come to expression instead. And only these mysterious imaginations, when realized, give the social organism a fitting form and structure. This is why the advances made in modern spiritual science are connected with the only wholesome, healing impulses for a socialist world order. The deficiencies and harm, the unhealthy nature of the modern social order, arises from the Fichtean way in which it seeks to forge from merely inner demands something that can only be grasped experientially. If we study the efforts of modern times to make the state increasingly centralized, it becomes clear that this has inevitably led to convulsions and disruptions in the social organism. The reasons for these convulsions and disturbances lie deeper than is recognized by those who see the modern proletarian movement only as a movement for fair wages or bread. For even if a movement for fair wages and bread is needed, it is not a matter just of rearranging salaries or bread distribution, but of how people seek to do so. And the reflections we have been engaging in today can show how we should approach such questions. Let us consider the question of added value that we came to at the end of yesterday's lecture. Anyone who has witnessed the proletarian revolution knows how incisive this question has been after its leaders implanted it as an idea in workers' souls. What is this added value theory based on? Really on what I described the day before yesterday at the public lecture in Basel, that an untruth does indeed hold sway nowadays in the relationship between employer and employee, though neither the employer nor the employee are aware of this untruth in their conscious mind. The fact is masked and hidden. But even though people are unaware of it, it still acts in the soul as a feeling. It rises up from subconscious depths. Let's recall the most important thing here. The employee today has a very specific relationship to his employer, which he feels to be unworthy of him, even if his conscious mind may sometimes see it very differently. Inwardly, he feels this relationship to be degrading to him, because it means he has to sell his labor to the employer or entrepreneur as any other commodity. In the secret depths of his soul, he feels that nothing that is part of a human being should be sold. When a person sells his labor, his whole being in reality accompanies it. We have already discussed this in the past. The question could be put as follows, and this is usually how it is put in socialist thinking. What is the right way of recompensing someone for their labor? Social ideals are usually concerned with paying full remuneration for manual labor, for a person's work. But in fact, the reality has to be seen quite differently. Anyone who understands economics will recognize that human labor cannot be exchanged for anything else at all. It cannot be paid for with any commodity or any commodity token, such as money. It is not a reality, but only an imaginary one, albeit realized in actuality, that a worker works and then is paid money for his labor. The truth is masked here, creates a kind of lie. What actually happens is quite different. In the social organism, it seems that the worker brings his labor to market, and the employer purchases this labor with the salary he pays. But this is not true at all. In the economic realm, one cannot do anything other than exchange one commodity for another. Commodity, of course, seen here in the very broadest terms. All economic activity consists, in reality, only in the exchange of goods. But what is a commodity in actual fact? A piece of land is, in itself, not yet a commodity. The coal in the ground is not yet a commodity. A commodity can only be something connected with human activity, either inwardly altered in nature by this activity, or transported by it from one place to another. If you consider these two possible attributes, you cover everything that can in any way be called a commodity. The nature of commodities has been much disputed, but if you understand economics, you realize that this is the only definition of any worth. Now, in the modern social organism, the circulation of goods has been fused or combined with other things, and this has driven this modern social organism to its revolutionary convulsions. Today it is thought, and this too is realized fantasy, not only that goods are exchanged for other goods, but also that goods are exchanged for human labor, as in the wage relationship. And furthermore, it is thought that goods, or their token, money, are exchanged for something that cannot be a commodity unless it has been changed or worked upon by human beings. Land, for instance. Land in itself is not subject to the economic process. Objects figuring in the economic process are obtained upon the land through human activity. But the land itself cannot be traded in the economic process. As far as the land and soil are concerned in the economy, in the social organism altogether, all we can say is that one person or another has a right to exclusive use of this land. This right to the land is what has real meaning for the social organism. The land and soil itself are not a commodity, but commodities are raised upon it. And this is governed by the right that the owner has to the land. So if you purchase a piece of land, that is, trade it for a commodity, you are exchanging a commodity for a right. And this is the case, too, when people buy patents. Here we meet the conflation that has caused such havoc between the purely political state and economic life, for which no other remedy exists but to separate the two. We must let economic life hold sway on its own terms, purely in the production of goods, circulation of goods, consumption of goods, in associative life, in which production, consumption, the various professional interests that unite people, enter into the right relationship. But within these associations and associative groups, economic activity only operates as the digestion does in our organism. And then, on the other hand, this digestion is engaged by the independent lung and heart system, which has its own relationship with the outer world. What lives in the digestive system is further received and encompassed by the independent heart and respiratory process. Thus, what is rightly rooted in economic life must, from a particular source, be discerned and established as independent. That means that political matters, and all that comes to expression in a life of rights and other such things, must have a relative independence and autonomy alongside economic life. If one comprehends this, one also sees the untruth existing in the relationship between employer and employee, apparent in the illusion that the employer is remunerating the employee for his labor. This labor is not directly paid for at all, but only indirectly. What we have here is a certain apparent law, but one that has become violation, economic violation, by means of which the employer compels the worker to station himself at the machine or in a factory, compels him, not entirely openly, but in another guise. What is actually exchanged here is not labor against commodity or commodity token, that is money, but output. The goods that the worker produces. And so what is really exchanged is a small portion of these goods that the employer gives the worker for the goods produced. Thus, commodity for commodity. And the untruth lies in the illusion that goods are being exchanged for labor. The modern proletarian sees this as a secret wrong and feels his human dignity is violated, expressing this in terms of the fact that he produces a certain amount of goods, but the employer allows him only a percentage of their value. The proper relationship between the employee and the employer cannot belong in the sphere of the economic process at all, but only in the sphere of the political state as a rights relationship. That is the important thing. On the foundation of economic life, on the one hand, and on that of the independent life of rights, on the other, this economic life is determined from two directions. From one perspective, economic life is dependent on natural factors, independent of human activity. For instance, as I explained in the public lectures in Basel, the natural yield of, say, a wheat crop, possible due to the soil in one region, will differ from that of another, and accordingly, different corresponding amounts of human labor will be required in each. These are the natural bases that affect economic activity on the one hand, and on the other have implications for labor governed by the life of rights, which must establish a fitting relationship here between employer and employee. Now, people with a merely superficial view of things will say that this is already the case, for such things are governed by the employment contract. Yet what use is this contract, my dear friends, if it governs what is in fact a concealed lie? The employment contract governs the relationship between employer and employee in regard to labor and remuneration. But the contract would only rightly apply if it made quite plain that it relates not to wages but to the manner in which employer and employee are to share the output that is produced. And then the worker, and this is the important thing, would recognize that it is not possible to do without the creation of added value. But he must consider how this added value arises. It must not be built into a relationship founded on a lie. Then he will come to see that without added value creation, one cannot have any culture or spiritual life, nor any rights state, for all this flows from added value. And if the social organism is healthy, all this will follow from the threefold social organism. This outlook is, of course, one we could speak about for days on end, as we almost have done now. Yet in the process we keep uncovering new details and aspects which should make it more comprehensible, since we can gain inklings of every specific question that might arise and the practical task of threefolding in attempting to answer it. The following, for instance, is one of the things that must be considered above all. In economic life, goods are exchanged, and the life of the political state, in the narrower sense, adjoins this economic life. In the sphere of human community and the life of rights, the political state limits or defines working hours. And so, while economic life is, on the one hand, dependent on natural foundations, as we saw, on the other, it is also dependent on decisions made in the rights sphere. Thus, about working hours, for instance, and the relationship between labor and the individual in matters such as his strength, his frailty, his age. There cannot be such a thing as a fixed length of the working day, but in reality only an upper and lower limit. All such things are conditions that affect economic life from one direction, just as natural foundations affect it from the other. If the social organism thus becomes healthier, then it will put an end to the really dreadful way in which remuneration is determined by economic factors themselves, so that wages rise when business is booming and can be reduced when it is not. This will be turned on its head. Business will boom as an effect of the worker's salary and vice versa. Ground rent, today largely dependent on the price of goods, the market price of goods produced on the land, can also illustrate these changes very clearly. The right and healthy relationship would be the opposite. When the right of use, expressed in ground rent, in turn affects market price. Often threefolding will lead to the very reverse of current conditions, which have caused our revolutionary convulsions. The whole of life will run differently. What must we consider, above all, in the relationship between economic life and the political state, in its narrower sense? One of these things you will easily ascertain yourselves. It is sometimes often regarded as unpleasant. Taxation. All that matters as regards taxation is that we can really clearly discern how taxes must flow from added value, and that in democratic political coexistence, we remain aware of the life of the political organism, just as we remain aware of economic life as we buy and sell. Thus clearly perceiving the reality of this economic relationship arising from human needs. And this in turn will lead to something indicative of a healthy social organism, and the opposite of what exists today. I'm not saying that we should change the taxation laws. Under present circumstances, there is much that cannot be altered, or can only be so by shifting what is wrong elsewhere. But a vital effect of the healthy threefold social organism will be that people develop a quite different view of particular aspects of society. They will come to see that the income a person procures is of no significance for the life of society as such, for human life in the social organism. As we procure our income, we detach ourselves from the social organism. And this can be a matter of great indifference to the social organism. The income someone earns has no importance whatsoever for its functions. Instead, a person becomes a social being by spending. Only as he spends does someone start to act with social relevance. And taxation must start precisely when we spend. I'm not referring here to indirect taxation, but expenditure tax, which is something quite different. It is beyond the scope of this lecture to give you all the details here, although the details can, of course, be worked out. It requires a deeper study of economics than we can engage in here. But I can point to some of the aspects involved. In healthy economic life, with its separation from the other spheres of the social organism, it becomes apparent that it costs more to grow wheat, say, in one region than another, due to soil conditions. And it may be that associative life alone cannot compensate for this difference. But it can be corrected entirely through the life of rights. And in such a case, it could come about entirely by itself that those who purchase wheat at a cheaper price, and thus spend less, must pay a higher tax than those who have to pay more for the wheat, and must thus spend more. If the rights state properly regulates laws in economic life, and if these laws are therefore not just an embodiment of vested economic interests, for instance, because the Farmers' Federation wields power in Parliament and the legislature, but are determined by those whose particular task it is to create laws and rights affecting human interrelationships, then it will be possible to fully and properly regulate economic life. I'm speaking generally and in the abstract. These things would have to be worked out in detail. But that broadly is the nature of the tax relationship between economic life and political life. The relationship between economic life and the life of rights on the one hand, and the life of culture on the other, is, however, one that can only be founded on trust and understanding. While taxation must be compulsory, even in the healthy social organism, the funding of spiritual life and culture can, on the other hand, only be voluntary, since the latter must be founded entirely on the human spirit and accord with the spirit of our humanity. It must be completely emancipated from everything else, and then it will, in turn, work back upon everything else in the strongest and profoundest way. I have only given you outlines of how the social organism should function if it is to be healthy. This threefolding is not an arbitrary invention, but simply what we can observe when we study the deeper forces at work in human evolution, which have become active today and will, whether or not we prefer otherwise, be realized in the next 10, 20, or 30 years. It can only be a matter of how they are realized. I have observed these forces and formulated them as an outlook, a way of seeing things. And it is generally true that historical insights can help us to perceive what is seeking realization. This is not an infringement of our freedom, for freedom relates to something quite different. It is as little a violation of our freedom as it is to say we can't grasp hold of the moon, although we might like to. Our freedom is realized in correspondence with necessities that lie equally in the natural and in the historical process of evolution. The end of Lecture 5.